This podcast is not personal financial advice. You're listening to the Aussie Firebug Podcast, the financial independence podcast for Australians. Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Aussie Firebug Podcast, the financial independence podcast for Aussies, where I interview clever people who have already reached or on their way to financial independence. Today I'm speaking to Paul Benson from the Financial Autonomy Podcast. Paul's a tertiary educated financial planner with over 20 years of experience. We're covering the role of a financial planner in today's episode because sometimes financial planners can cop it a bit in the FIRE community. I've seen a few comments on the Facebook group where people have had bad experiences, and I just don't want to, and we shouldn't paint everyone with the same brush. So I wanted to give a financial planner the opportunity to come on the podcast and set the record straight. We'll be talking about such things as what do financial planners do, how much do they cost, how they can assist you with your journey towards financial independence, and what to look out for when choosing one. So let's get into it after a quick word from our sponsor. Today's episode is brought to you by our partners at ShareSite, the number one portfolio tracking tool for Aussie investors. ShareSite makes it ridiculously simple with automatic holdings updates, comprehensive tax and performance reporting, wrapped up in an easy-to-use, fully cloud-based system. My favorite thing about using ShareSite is how easy it makes tax returns. Simply generate your tax report at the end of the financial year and voila, you're done. And here's the best part. It's 100% free for users that have under 10 holdings. If you have over 10 holdings and want to sign up, make sure you use my link to get the first 4 months for free. Head over to aussiefirebug.com/ShareSite to receive this special offer. Even if you're signing up to the free plan, using that link will score you 4 months for free if you ever decide to own more than 10 holdings within 60 days. Finish tax time with a click of a button using ShareSite by signing up today. That's aussiefirebug.com/ShareSite for your free 4 months. Hey guys, welcome back to another episode. I've got Paul Benson here from the very popular podcast Financial Autonomy. Welcome, Paul.
Hey, g'day, Matt. Thanks for having me on.
No worries. Now, the theme of today's episode is all about the role of a financial planner on the journey towards FIRE. Now, Paul, for those who haven't heard of you before, can you tell the audience a little bit about yourself and what you're all about, mate?
Yeah, thanks, Matt. So look, I'm a financial planner. That's how I, you know, put food on the table. I've been doing that for about 20 years and been doing it self-employed or on my own business since 2006, so quite a long time. And I guess the way that, you know, you and I come into the same circles is through the podcast, Financial Autonomy, that you mentioned. And we've been doing that about 4 years, and that's been a heap of fun and has really helped in terms of, I guess, as a financial planner and growing the business and, I guess, getting clients that have a similar interest and a similar train of thought to sort of where we're at. And that's been great. It's led to a book deal, and we have a weekly email that goes out, which is a lot of fun. And in fact, we're just doing a second podcast at the moment where with a colleague, Justin Balduri, and we record it live on YouTube so that people that are interested can actually jump on and have their 2 cents worth as well. So that's a fun new project that we're doing. So that's sort of it. And as I say, day-to-day financial planner, and then, you know, content creation's about one day a week and having a lot of fun.
Yeah, great. Now, we actually, just a little side story to start things off here, but we actually have already met over a radio segment many years ago. We were speaking a little bit about it before we started recording, but I should have looked it up, but it must have been like 3 or 4 years ago that I can't remember the program either. Can you remember?
Yeah, it was Radio National. Yeah, Life Matters. Yeah, I pop up on there occasionally.
Wow, so, there you go.
That's right. And they had us both on, which was good.
Yeah, so not the first time. And just for a bit of background for those who are listening, this topic of financial planners and their role and how they can assist people on the journey towards FIRE is very polarizing, and people have strong opinions about it. And I myself use, with my accountant, I pay him money to do some modeling and to help me out with my finances and my planning, which a lot of people listening might think, like, you pay someone to do that? Like, I thought you knew, you know, a whole bunch about finances. And hey, I've read a few books. I'm definitely not an expert by any means, but I have a pretty good understanding of my plan and where I want to go with in the future with my finances. But even the great Peter Thornhill himself pays someone to look after his finances or to help him assist with his finances. So I guess it's similar to like an athlete, a professional athlete paying, you know, a coach and having them coach. And that's how I sort of approach it. But the conversations and the comments I see online, I just really wanted to reach out to the financial planning community. So I put a question out in the Facebook group and I said, I'm trying to get a financial planner on. And Paul, your name was the most liked
out of all the comments on there. So
this is lovely. Thank you. You've got a great audience.
Yeah, no, it just goes to show, you know, the great work you're doing in your podcast and the other content that you create. So a lot of people got around your name, so I shot out the email and here you are. So let's kick things off with what exactly is a financial planner. How about we start there?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, these days, fortunately, to call yourself a financial planner, you do need to be licensed. So you need to be on the ASIC register and that, I guess, vets people for certain issues. You know, ASIC can scrub people off the register if they have complaints or if there's certain issues like that. So, and to be on the register means that you have to meet certain education requirements. You also have to have professional indemnity insurance, those sort of things. So there's a, I guess, a regulatory requirement around what it means to be a financial planner. And it wasn't that long ago that anyone could actually call themselves a financial planner. So you might have had, you know, property spruikers and these type of people use that term. But fortunately, now it's actually enshrined in law and yet to have to be, you know, properly licensed in order to be able to use, whether it's financial planner or financial advisor, they're interchangeable, same term. So that's from the legal side. I guess the other element is what does a financial planner do? And that's really around helping people achieve their goals. Certainly, at least that's the focus that we have. I guess there would be some planners that maybe would steer more towards calling themselves investment advisors. And you do get some in the space too that specialize only in insurance. But the majority and certainly where we sit is, all right, what are people's goals? What are they trying to achieve? And then, all right, how can we develop strategies, do modeling, scenario analysis, these type of things to achieve those particular goals?
Yeah. And actually, that was going to be my other question about, is there a difference between a financial and advisor and a financial planner? But I think you've answered it there. They're the same thing.
Same thing.
And just another question just with you talking there. So you have to be qualified to meet the regulatory requirements to call yourself a financial planner. Now, that is changing in the future, I believe, that you will have to be tertiary educated. Is that right?
Yeah, pretty much. So pretty much anyone that would have become a financial planner in the last 5 or 6 years would have had to be tertiary qualified anyway, but older planners wouldn't have had to in the past. They could have done, you know, other training. But yeah, increasingly, you need to be tertiary qualified. And they pushed it out, I think it's 2026 now, everyone has to be tertiary qualified. So even if you've been in the industry for 30 years, you got in before that requirement, you have to go back and do a degree, which is interesting. So, you know, a few of the old ones are exiting as a result. But yeah, no, the standards are pretty high. So your tertiary qualifications, you've got to do a competency exam. Once you complete that, then you have to do a year's supervised work. So you have to work under another licensed advisor who's sort of responsible for any of the advice that you give. Yeah, it's pretty high standards these days. And in fact, that's sort of contributed there's really a shortage of financial planners at the moment. So yeah, look, I don't know if it's relevant, but certainly, you know, some of our listeners, one in particular that I'm thinking of, a client that we're working with, you know, interested in personal finance. I imagine your listeners are too. You know, a career in financial planning, particularly if you've already got a business degree, is something that you might want to think about because there's demand there and it's a great career, but it's not a career you can really hit at a 20-year-old. It's a good career for a little bit later in life. And yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful role. You know, you're talking to people every day and different circumstances, you get to know people. Certainly it's a great space to work in. I'd recommend it to anyone.
Mm. Now we're going to get into a lot about what the financial planner does, how it can add value, all that good stuff. But I want to now ask you, it's a bit of a sticky question and I don't, you know, it's a bit of a sensitive area, but I have to ask it because it's really prompted this whole podcast. Do you have any theories as to why there seems to be such a bad rep when it comes to financial planners in Australia that is rarely seen in other industries? I know there was the whole Royal Commission that happened in 2018 that probably didn't paint financial planners in the best light. And I'm not saying all of them, you know, were bad, but there was a few revelations that happened out of that I think a few people, you know, raised a few eyebrows. But it just seems to me, it seems crazy to me that financial planners are the experts. They got the experience in this specific niche. And a lot of people that do have a lot of wealth, like I know, like the data as well backs this up. I think there's less than 10% of Australians that have used a financial planner. I ran a FIRE survey at the start of the year, and the FIRE community, I would say, is probably one of the wealthiest niche communities out there. It's got to be, you know, around the top anyway. And out of that survey, there was something like less than 16% of people that are chasing FIRE have seen a financial planner. And the 16% that did see a financial planner, 49% of them wouldn't see one again, which is really, really disappointing. And I myself, as I mentioned, I use, I speak with my accountant more than once a year. I pay him money for his services. So I just don't know why this is happening, and I just want to pick your brains on this.
Yeah, look, I think there's probably quite a few factors. So you touched on the Royal Commission. I think that highlighted issues with institutional ownership of financial planning, particularly the banks. And as I say, I went out on my own in 2006, so I started my financial planning career working for a bank. That was sort of, I think of that as my apprenticeship. And you've just got a problem there. There's a conflict because they're manufacturing product and then they're also trying to give advice. And that ultimately means that there's an expectation that the advisor has a sales obligation. And, you know, that's why I left. And, you know, that they were the big issues really that come out of the Royal Commission. Now, fortunately, the banks have all left the financial planning space now. So I think that's good for all concerned. But I would imagine that would be a contributor to people's, you know, negative perceptions. And as I say, fortunately, that's largely changed. I mean, there's still the AMPs of the world, but they're a shadow of their former self. I mean, if you're seeing a financial planner, to some extent, you're looking to outsource, right? Now, I would imagine in the FIRE community, you're pretty engaged. And like we see that within financial autonomy as well. You're more engaged than the average person in finances and investment. And so maybe you're a bit less inclined to outsource. You're maybe more inclined to DIY. And I think in all space, you know, some people DIY the servicing of their own car, or they DIY their own plumbing, or they DIY painting their own house. And there's going to be a proportion of the population that's quite happy to DIY their own finances. And if you do enough research and enough reading, I'm sure you can, you know. So I guess the other thing is, look, not everyone needs a financial planner, and certainly they don't need it all the time. So like we would often see someone who's got along perfectly fine without a financial planner, and then they receive an inheritance or something kind of, or they get divorced or something like that. And there's, okay, now's the time when I need a planner. But they've been totally fine without one for 20 odd years or 30 years or more. And also, I guess what you see sometimes is sort of an episodic need. So historically, and you know, as a business owner, what we like is the long-term relationships, right? And ideally someone where, you know, you catch up once a year for a review, or we call them progress meetings, and you do that sort of ongoing coaching. But not everybody needs that. And historically, the financial planning profession kind of wasn't very good at people who didn't need that, who just needed the once off. But I think we're getting a lot better at that. And, you know, I think that's probably a need more and more, and certainly we're seeing more and more. And hopefully later, I've got a couple of case studies I can sort of share with you of people in that FIRE space and work we're doing right now that I think will kind of bring that to light. So just thinking specifically about the FIRE community, I mean, I would imagine that there would be some financial planners where people come in and said, hey, I've got this FIRE objective and I want to retire when I'm 50 or something. There would certainly be some planners that would go, you know, you're kidding yourself, right? They're just not going to be on that page. And that's, all right, we just got to shop around. You know, they're probably more focused on traditional retirees building up super, and then how can we sort you out once you're over age 60. And so maybe, you know, thinking about your audience and the community and the feedback there, I could imagine there would be planners who they wouldn't gel with, because that sort of FIRE ambition is not, I guess, mainstream financial planner talk.
Can you touch on a little bit, or dive into, you mentioned that when you work for the banks, there was a bit of a conflict of interest. And it was, yeah, okay. So I think I know where you're going, but can you explain that conflict of interest? And we have, you know, we're sort of jumping a bit ahead to what to avoid with a financial planner. But I'd like to know personally, what did you see working for that bank when you were trying to give financial advice, but you were also incentivized as part of your job to sell a financial product? Like, just can you walk us through a few of those examples?
Oh, for sure. Easy. When I was there, we had a weekly sales target. You know, we had to, righto, you need to do 300,000 in new business a week or whatever the requirement was. And for most of the time I was there, the only products that you could use were the products owned by the bank. So, yeah, there's a massive conflict, right? And, yeah, it's not good. And that's why the banks got smacked over the head in the Royal Commission. And that's why most of the good planners had already left, and those that were still around definitely left afterwards. And that's why the banks aren't in it anymore. You know, advice should be standalone. Like, a significant amount of the work we do never even has a product recommendation. It's all about financial modelling and scenario analysis. But I could never do that when I work for the bank, because how's that going to pay? And part of that too was, oh, financial plans are free or near free, right? Which you could do in the bank because they knew you were going to sell a product and they'd make money off the product. But once you separate advice as a standalone business, so it's more like your accountant, more like your solicitor, more like any other profession, and you don't make any money off product sales, which is as it should be, well, then obviously you just got to be prepared to pay for it as the consumer. But yeah, so that's the conflict. It's if you've got an advice business that's also a product manufacturer, it doesn't work.
Yeah, right. And what was the actual recommendations from that Royal Commission in terms of what they recommended specifically for the financial planning? Do you know? Or
I mean, look, there were broad issues around, well, fee disclosure type stuff, which was kind of always there but tightened up. To be honest, my impression just overall, because it was pretty far-reaching and it went for, 9 months or something, was it really just shamed the financial those big financial institutions. It just shamed them.
Yeah.
To the point where, hey, this isn't worth the negative PR we're getting here. Because pretty much what they had is thousands and thousands of clients that they didn't really treat as clients. They just sort of treated as a cash cow and actually didn't do very much work for.
Yeah, sometimes I find the Royal Commissions, like, nothing actually eventuates out of them. Like, it's just is it a political thing that we're doing something, we're going to spend all this taxpayers' money and it's a big hoo-ha and it's on, the ABC and there's all articles written about it, Four Corners, whatever. But then, like, what actually happens? I'm sure there was stuff that actually happened out of it. I don't know. But yeah, it seems to me, well, maybe the qualifications and the tightening of the regulatory requirements.
That was already happening, actually. So it was really just, as I say, it was just a cleaning out of the industry. It almost just sort of kicked the industry forward a few years, mainly by just pushing the banks out, which is great.
Okay, so we talked a little bit about the institutions and how they're motivated by, they've got different motivations than a standalone advisor. So how do financial planners get paid? Is there a standard?
Just charge a fee. Same as accountant, same as your solicitor.
So is that all of them, or is like the model that you described before with the financial, with the institution planners, are they still around?
There's still your AMPs and IWFs, a couple, but most of those people wouldn't be employees anyway. So yeah, look, it should be all fees. I mean, in the investment space, superannuation space, there's no commissions anywhere. They were banned years ago. There are still commissions associated with insurance. So you could get someone, as I say, there are some people that are just insurance specialists, so they maybe wouldn't charge a fee and they would just rely on the commissions off the insurance. Like in our case, we do a bit of insurance because our clients are generally sort of Gen X or millennials, so it's pretty relevant. Income protection, life insurance to protect the kids, that sort of stuff. So we would get a little bit of income there. It's about 10% of our revenue. It's not a big deal. But yeah, for advice, for strategy, all that sort of stuff, you just pay a fee.
A fee. So how much are we talking? I know this is going to vary greatly depending on what you're after, but is there any standard costing models when it comes to financial advice?
Yeah, I mean, as an indication, like our financial autonomy program is $4,400, so $4,000 plus GST, and we spread that over 12 months to help make that affordable for people. And generally, this seems to be sort of $3,000 to $5,000 or $6,000 for a full financial plan.
Is that a statement of advice?
Includes the statement of advice, includes implementation. But yeah, the statement of advice. So that's a good point, because sometimes people might go, well, gee, that's a lot of money. How can it possibly cost that much, right?
So of course, yeah.
Financial planning in Australia is very highly regulated and it's around consumer protection. And so, yeah, one of the things, exactly as you mentioned, to give advice, you can't go into it, or an advisor, if you sat in their office or you had a Zoom meeting with them, which is what we're doing lots of now, and you said, hey, I've just got this question, can you tell me? The advisor can't sit on the other side of the desk and say, right, your answer is do this. Right? That's illegal. Any advice that you provide has to be in writing and it has to be in the format of a statement of advice. And you have to show that you've considered their full financial situation. So that's why people that do deal with a financial planner, there'll be some sort of questionnaire type process to get their full balance sheet, to understand what their super is, their risk profile, these sort of things, even health questions, that sort of stuff. Because by law, you have to understand a person's full financial position, because otherwise you could say, oh, what you should do is do that, ignorant that, oh, hang on a minute, they've got some health condition that means, whatever. So you have to do that, right? So, yeah, so the advice process and the costs reflect producing that document, and you have to do a lot of research too on existing products and that sort of stuff too. The other element probably, again, just if people are like, gee, that sounds like a lot of money. So to run a financial planning practice, and as I say, we have our own license. So I don't literally sign the checks because there aren't checks anymore, but you know what I mean? I pay the bills, right? So yeah. Professional indemnity insurance is about $20,000 a year. ASIC regulatory fees, about $5,000 a year. The audit for your Australian Financial Services license, $5,000. You've got to get compliance audits for the advisors and sort of this ongoing compliance work that person does for us there. That's about 10 grand a year. You've got to get specialist financial planning software, which is about 20 grand a year. Research software is about, about 5 grand-ish, I think. Let alone all your normal internet and phones and Office 365 and all the normal kind of stuff that any other business would have. So, but all that exists to provide consumer protection, right? You could not have a whole lot of that and it would make it a lot cheaper, but it would also mean a greater risk of people's savings going up in smoke. And particularly in Australia where you don't have a choice, you have to contribute to super, government makes you do it. You know, there's a view that, well, we've got to have pretty high levels of consumer protection, higher than most other countries because of that compulsory superannuation, compulsory savings. Our system requires people to provide for their own retirement. And so that's why those rules exist. So I don't know. It's a bit of a long-winded answer, but that's how it all kind of feeds in.
Mm. Do you think, and I remembered a comment on another Facebook group that I seen once. It seems to me that there's a lot of red tape, regulatory requirements to protect the consumer, but that comes at a cost, as you've spoken about. It's not cheap. So when someone asks a simple question, you have to bring in the entire financial picture to give them advice officially. Professionally, like, do you think that it's almost over-regulated, there's too much red tape, and it is making it hard for financial planners to give good advice because it's so expensive? And I'll use probably the famous person in Australia as an example for when people just want like an answer that maybe is going to point them in the right direction. The Barefoot Investor. Now, I know that he was a financial planner and he had a license and all that good stuff, but people used to write into his column and they used to ask him a whole bunch of questions and he used to give. Now, I don't know if it was advice or it wasn't, but like you see this happening all around the internet now. And I'm curious to see, to hear your thoughts on like the whole finfluencer movement that's happening, because you got people on YouTube, you got people on TikTok, you got people on Instagram giving, it's not financial advice. Even I do a Q&A monthly. Now I say it's not financial advice, it isn't, but I'm saying what I would do in certain situations. So the most famous of them is most likely the Barefoot Investor. So you look at him and he answers a question in a column. It's easy. They didn't write in their entire financial, you know, picture, and he gives them a pretty good, you know, kick-ass answer and away they go. And then people come to a financial planner and they might ask a simple question they meet initially. It's like, boom, $4,000. Like, holy God, I could just ask, you know, this person on the internet, or I just want to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, I understand that he's not a licensed advisor anymore. I think he got a bit of heat for some of that because, yeah, it doesn't seem to be consistent with the law.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I mean, it's interesting, as you know, as we've mentioned, I mean, I put out a podcast too now and yeah, we, you know, try, hey, it's not advice, it's general information. So there is a bit of room there for what you and I do on the podcast, which is that you are allowed to provide general information. So for instance, you can say, well, look, the contribution cap for concessional superannuation contributions is $27,500 a year, right? You can provide factual information to someone. What you can't do is sort of tailor the information based on the facts of the individual without putting it in a statement of advice.
Do you feel as though it's a level playing field is what I'm getting at? Because of that comment on Facebook that I read, it, and I wish I had it in front of me, it was really good. It was in another one. It was a financial planner and he'd written this big thing. It's like, I wish ASIC or whoever is the regulatory body that does this would even the playing field, because people are going to, you know, these online people and they're just getting easy answers. And
I don't share that view. I'm okay with it. I think that people can tell the difference, and I am glad that professional financial planners are held to a higher standard. And I guess this circles back to your earlier point. You know, when I started financial planning 20 years ago, you didn't need a degree. I mean, I had one, but you didn't need one. And you didn't need to do a heck of a lot of training either, right? And so, you know, there are people that have been in the industry a long time, and many of them are excellent because they've got a lot of experience and they've learnt on the job, but that hasn't always been the way. So to the extent that these standards are lifting the standards, I think is good. I would hope that maybe 5-10 years from now, everyone across the profession is at such a high level that there is scope to ease back. And you could get more like a solicitor or accountant where it is possible to just have a 1-hour consult and just talk people through it. But I think we needed to go through where we are now. And I think we probably still need to go a bit further with that yet until you do get a real changing of generations of all the advisors, so that everyone working in the space has done all the qualifications and the ethics units and the everything required. And then, yeah, hopefully there's an ability to maybe ease up on that in the future.
Okay. Now, what should people expect to get out of a financial planner when they go see one? What do you, like, you've been in the industry for over 20 years. What are sort of the main goals that you see people coming to a financial planner with?
Yeah, sure. So starting point, clarity on your goals. If you're not already, if you don't already have clarity on your goals, then you want to be working with your advisor and nailing that down. So very often people will come in and their goals are a bit vague, or they're not prioritized, or it's a couple and actually the couple haven't discussed it. So you get one member of the couple say, well, I really want to, you know, buy a boat and sail around the world. And the other one, the couple's going, what? I don't want to do that. It's funny, you know. So, and you do sometimes get, particularly I see it where like the hubby's been reluctant and the wife's kind of dragged him in, you know, by the ear, because she's like, we've got to get this sorted out, you know. So certainly goals is what it's all about as the beginning point, because any work you do kind of flows from those goals. So from there, the planner's going to get your financial position and, you know, various bits of background information, and then they're going to prepare a strategy and do whatever work's necessary to assist you in achieving those goals. So maybe, as I mentioned before, I've got a couple of case studies of just current jobs that we've got on. Do you want me to maybe take you through those? Because that might sort of bring it to life for the listeners.
Yeah, sure. Case study would be fine.
So we've got, so there's one that we're working on like right now. My paraplanner's working on it yesterday and he'll be back into it again tomorrow. A couple who are pursuing the FIRE goal, and their youngest will finish high school in 3 years. And their intention is once he finishes high school, that's the point, right, we're free. They want to travel around Australia for a couple of years, and then sort of decide where they want to live long term, whether they come back to Melbourne or maybe in the travels they find somewhere they love, and in which case they sell up and move up there. So it's sort of, all right, we're getting there and we've had this FIRE plan, we've built up these investments, and we're just starting to think about how we kind of make all this happen. And so they came, their issues, their reason for engaging us was, for one, look, we just want to check that we've got our numbers right and we're not going to find ourselves at 75 and we've run out of money or something, which is everyone's worst fear, right? But probably, like, really, they're pretty smart people. I think they knew they were okay, but still, I guess it's nice to have someone else confirm. Really, though, the bigger issue is with their investment portfolio, they got a 30 grand tax bill for last financial year. Markets were pretty positive. They got a big tax bill. And so they're thinking, well, gee, have we actually got this structured the best way that it could be? And thinking about, we're about to move into this phase, we're going to maybe move to a bit of part-time work, then give it up altogether, as I say, in 3 years' time and go traveling. Do we need to be restructuring things a bit here to get this more tax effective? And so the work that we're doing, so the initial work was just, look, is there any risk that you're going to run out of money here? You know, from a longevity point of view, yep, that was a pretty easy box to tick. But then what we had a look at was, well, all right, from, and I'm sure you would have covered this in the podcast before, but really from 60 onwards, you really want your income to come out of super, because then it's all tax-free, there's no tax on the earnings, et cetera, right? But in their case, they're going to have about 8 years pre-60, so therefore we need to fund that from their non-super investments. But what we determined is actually they had more in these non-super investments than they really needed, which was inefficient from a tax point of view. So then we're working through a strategy at the moment of, well, all right, we want to build their super, particularly the wife's super, because as is quite common, you know, the wife had time out of the workforce to look after the kids. So she's got drastically less super than the husband. So we want to build up the super, but we need to think about the fact that their investments, to do that, we've got to sell down their investments. We've already got to sell down their investments to have the income to support them through this period. But if we want to sell extra to be able to contribute to super, that's going to trigger capital gains tax. So how can we progressively manage that to minimise the amount of capital gains tax they pay, get as much into super as we possibly can without going over the limits, so that then when they hit 60, they can draw tax-free income? And in this case, there's a three-year age gap. The wife's 3 years older than the husband. So you've got a period there where we can access the wife's super but not the husband's super. So anyway, this is the sort of stuff that we're working on. And they're ones, like I touched on before, I think after we do this project, I don't imagine they're going to be wanting to do an annual review each year. I think this will probably just be a one-off project and maybe they come back in 5 years, because once they've got clarity on, okay, this is the structure, and yeah, we're just going to have a mapped out, right, in 2022, this is what you need to do, you know, in terms of super contributions, I think they'll be on their way. So that's, I guess, an example. And as I mentioned before, like, there's no product recommendations in any of that. It's just number crunching, looking at scenarios. You know, we did, well, what if returns are at different rates? You know, sort of worst case, what if you only earn 4%? What if you earn 6%? What if you earn 8%? Different milestones, those type of things. So that's one, a live one that we're working on now. And another one that I just presented last night, actually, was an interesting one. So a young couple recently married, or married about a year ago, planning on starting a family in about a year's time, just about to knock down their home and build a new one on it, which means they're going to borrow another $500,000. So they'll end up with about an $800,000 mortgage and would like to retire at 50. So they wanted to think about, well, you know, we're going to have kids, which means expenses are going to go up. Our income's probably going to go down because at the moment there's two wages, but there's going to be maternity leave, et cetera, probably going to be a bit less wage. So we're going to have less income. We've got a bigger mortgage. Is that all going to fly? And then how does that all feed into us retiring at 50? So we did a fair bit of work. They had really good numbers around their budget, so we could be quite confident from a cash flow perspective that that was accurate. Most people don't. And we could just run the numbers again, just thinking about, well, what if it only earned 6%, you know, different sort of scenarios. And the conclusion we come to there is, look, 50 is probably not realistic, but 55 probably is. And that was working. So again, there was a 3-year age gap here. So that was 55 as the oldest member of the couple. So the youngest member of the couple would have been 52. So for her, you know, it wasn't miles away. And we talked about, well, look, here's the way it could be possible. I mean, get a promotion and earn an extra 20 grand a year or something. It changes the game, right? So, but again, just, yeah, that was just looking at, well, here's the scenarios. Here's how that shapes up. And yeah, 50, maybe not. And we showed, look, it's possible, but you'd have to cut your expenses down to this level. You sure you really want to do that? And they sort of, even before having any great discussion on it, no, we really don't want to do that.
You should have told them to join the fire group, mate.
I think they're already in that community. But
oh, they are they?
I would think so. Yeah, they're into it. Well, anyway, everyone's a bit different there. But, you know, you've got a young family, you've got to enjoy it, right? So there's no point being frugal to the point of not enjoying life and having
yes.
regrets later. So, you know, the extent of how much they'd need to cut their expenses wouldn't have been a lot of fun. So, yeah, so anyhow, look, there's just a couple of examples of the sort of work that we do for people that have those, I guess, early retirement type objectives.
Sure. So both of those examples, you delivered the solution or the recommendation in the form of a statement of advice, I'm assuming. So if you don't mind me asking, how much in both of those examples, what was that statement of advice? How much did it cost?
Oh, so that's the $4,400.
So that's $4,400 got them the different modeling situations. Okay.
Yeah, it got all that work. And in this case, there was no implementation, but, you know, for a lot of times there is, so it would cover the cost of implementation as well.
Yeah, and that's a once-off fee for that, yeah, to deliver that modeling. Okay, cool. So what do you think is the biggest value add a financial planner can give to a client? If someone has a dialed-in FIRE plan, where do you see a financial planner adding value?
Look, as I said, I don't think every FIRE person probably needs a financial planner. If they're really good on analysis and an Excel spreadsheet and you're really across it, or alternatively, you can just say that, hey, I could earn 2% a year and I'm still fine, right? You've got enough safety margin. You probably don't need a financial planner. And as I touched on, there probably aren't enough financial planners to go around anyway. So it's fine. So it would be if, I guess, like the two examples that I gave, particularly the one where it's only a few years away, is if you just, look, we think we've got this right, but we'd sort of like someone else just to have a fresh set of eyes. You don't know what you don't know, right? All of us face that challenge. So I would think that's really where the value lies.
Mm. And I also think it depends on how much you value your time and if you love doing that sort of work, because I pay my accountant to do some modeling for me. I pay him to keep up to date with trust laws. We invest through a trust. Like, I don't want to be up to date with all that stuff. That's, you know, that doesn't interest me at all. Contrary to popular belief, like, I don't live inside a spreadsheet every day. So I find that is a very good price to pay to outsource that time and energy to someone else that's a professional and lives and breathes that stuff.
Tax deductible too.
And it's tax deductible. That's right. Now, probably the most important question, or one of the most important questions on this pod, how do we tell the difference between a good financial planner and a bad one? Is there a directory or a list that you could recommend to finding a good financial planner, other than yourself, of course?
So, look, ASIC has a registry. So if you Google, I think it's called, it's nothing very cryptic, it's like financial planner register or something along those lines.
We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah. And you know, you just type in the person's name and it'll come up with their license history. So it'll tell you who they've been licensed from in the past, whether they've had any complaints, anything like that. So that's great. Like, that's only been around about 2 or 3 years, but that's a really good resource. Beyond that, I mean, I would advocate probably the Financial Planning Association. There are two professional associations, but the financial planning one has historically had the sort of higher standards. But someone who goes to the trouble, particularly if they're a certified financial planner, someone who goes to the trouble of, you know, doing the extra studies to become certified, they're obviously pretty serious about their career and wanting to make it their career. They haven't just sort of swung in and gone, I'll do this for 6 months and move on to something else if they've bothered to go and get a become a certified financial planner. So I think that's a good threshold. And beyond that, as I say, not everyone has an ongoing relationship, but often you do. You've got to find someone that works for you. And that might come about through friends or colleagues that have worked with someone. And if you kind of feel, hey, we're kind of on a similar, you know, view of the world. So if they get along with this particular planner, maybe I will too. I mean, that's not going to be your only filter, but it's not a bad start. But if you sit down with a planner and you just feel this person's not really listening to me, or they're just not on the same wavelength, you know, you probably keep looking, because you've got to feel that, well, certainly that they're listening, for one. And I can understand, you know, as we touched on before, why there would be some people in the FIRE community who maybe that wouldn't work, right? Some of your old-time planners who are Absolutely. Really only interested in people over 60 and some 30-year-old who tells them they want to retire when they're 50, they're just going to go piss off, you know. So that's not going to work. So you've got to find someone who's listening, who's on your page. Look at the ASIC registry, probably look at the FPAs, particularly ideally see if they're a certified financial planner. And I think it's not always possible, but I think what helps for us, if there's an ability, if they put out an email or they do a podcast or they do something which gives you an opportunity to just have a listen and kind of see, Cisco, I talk on my language, that's kind of helpful too. Now, that's not possible for everybody, but increasingly it is more and more. So that might help as well.
I would suspect as well, and you'd know better than me, but the people probably have a more positive experience if they come with a little bit of knowledge and they understand some of the jargon and they've got the right questions to ask for. Because I'm going to guess if someone rocks up and hires you and, you know, wants to get a statement of advice, they've got no idea about goals, they don't know where they want to go in life, and they just want to be rich or something. Just make me rich. You're a financial planner. I'm going to guess that they're probably not going to have a great time. I don't know if you found that.
You're right. The goals is the biggie. Yep. So if they don't have clarity on that, it makes it really hard. Probably the other one too is just vagary around, I mean, we need to know, well, how much have you got in your super? What option is it in? Is it in the capital stable or the growth? How much do you owe on your mortgage? And these days you should be able to just look that up on your phone. But you know, often people have got no clue. Or the other one, and just for your listeners, this is something that I find frustrating, so just so your listeners can avoid it. If it's a couple, I want to meet both members of the couple, right? Don't just come in with one and then I go, okay, so how much is in your wife's super? Oh, I don't know. Well, you're a couple. I need to know. And you should know, and she should know your super, and, you know, it's like whatever. I mean, if you're a couple, do it together. So that's just a personal frustration of mine. Yeah, so yeah, it is helpful. Again, you go into a financial planner because you want to outsource things, you want to get some expertise, and in some cases you're not very interested in financial matters, probably not the listeners to this podcast, but certainly that is some people that we deal with. So I don't expect that you know heaps, but certainly if you at least had a bit of clarity, hey, I want to. The other one that people often aren't very clear on, but I suspect your listeners would be, is how much do we spend? It's amazing how many people have no idea. And so usually what we have to do, in fact, even if they tell me, oh yeah, we spend that much, is then we go backwards and just say, okay, so how much did you save, right? You did this extra into the offset account, blah, blah, blah. Okay, well, if we subtract that off your after-tax income, then that means you should have spent about this. Does that kind of align? And so often they say, oh, we spend 60 grand a year, and then you do the numbers and it's more like 100 or it's 80 or, you know, it's just, well, hang on a minute, what's the difference here?
That happens in the FIRE community as well. There's plenty of people that think they spend X amount, and when they actually track it, it's a lot different, you know. That's why always my number one like tip, if you're serious about it, track your expenses. You don't need to do it to the dollar, but like, you know, do it once a month and get a pretty good idea. And yeah, because if you don't, you know, what's measured is managed, and you won't know your FIRE number unless you know exactly how much you're spending.
Yeah, exactly right. And from us, in terms of trying to do a plan, if we don't know what you spend, we don't know what you can save, we don't know how much we need to be allowing for in retirement, whenever that retirement is. So yeah, it's pretty helpful if you can give us some degree of accuracy on that.
Now, if someone has a bad experience with a financial planner, you mentioned that there is the lookup on ASIC, I think.
Through ASIC, yeah.
Now, I'll link that in the show notes. So is that literally, you can see the reviews of that financial planner, like negative and positive, or?
No, it doesn't have that sort of stuff. It's only if it was a like an official sort of complaint or something, it goes up there. There is, I haven't looked at it for ages, but I know there's a site called Advisor Ratings that was, you know, supposed to be a bit of a trip advisor or something for financial planners. Yeah. I'm not sure.
It makes sense.
It does. As I say, I haven't looked at it for a couple of years. The only thing is I think it's a bit prone to manipulation because advisors who are really keen on it could go to a lot of trouble to convince people to go and leave reviews. And then other people who are it's not front of mind for them don't even think about it and maybe you know, they only get one review. But actually they might have 100 clients who love them but they've just never said to the clients, hey, would you mind jumping on advisor ratings and leave? It's like the client's not going to naturally think to do that, right? So unless the advisor prompts them. So I'd imagine you could probably game it a little bit. But, that's the only – I think there might be more, but off the cuff I couldn't tell you any other
stuff. Because it seems to be the number one question when I see it pop up. On the Facebook group, you know, I'm thinking about going to see a financial planner. Can anyone recommend a good one? And what to look out for? What are the red flags? And I know for me, even my parents that have been to financial planners, I was really unhappy with that. They did two things, and you know, I won't name names or companies or anything, but they were recommending very complicated investments and something that my old man and mom, they're property investors, you know. They dabbled in the share market. They lost money, never again, but that's a whole nother story. And the guy, he's talking about derivatives and like really a bit complex financial instruments. And I thought, what is this guy doing? And this is after I learned about the index investing and FIRE and everything. I thought, you guys do not need that. Like, I don't know what this guy, why he's recommending you this product. I don't see how, in what world he would recommend you this product. And the other thing was the yearly fee. And my old man, because I went through when I got back from London this year, I went through how much they were getting charged from this company. And he was complaining a lot because it, you know, wasn't returning how much he wanted it to return. I had to explain to him that it was, you know, coronavirus crash and everything like that. But they were getting charged a fee. And I'm like, has anyone actually rang you in the last 12 months and done anything to you? And he said no. And like, maybe they sent him an email. I'm not sure. But it sort of annoyed me a little bit that it was a yearly fee that they were getting charged and no one had done anything. There was no change of product. There was no advice, no nothing. It was just like set on autopilot. It was almost like a subscription that they'd flicked on and the work hadn't been done. And that really annoyed me. And I felt like if there was a sort of a review or something that I could leave against this company, I would have.
Yeah, that's really poor. And I mean, that's exactly what the Royal Commission found. So that's really sad to hear that there's still instances of that because, certainly if you're paying an ongoing advice fee, then you should, you know, typically that would mean a review once a year and typically updates and a bit of contact over the course of the year. You don't want to be faffing around with the portfolio too much. So it's probably not surprising that they haven't moved investments because you don't want to fiddle. But yeah, particularly there should be one formal review a year, which is pretty full on and pretty in depth. And yeah, usually a bit of support during the year too. So yeah, that's disappointing to hear. But see if you can give them a nasty review or something. Do what you can because I don't want my profession sort of tarnished with that kind of practice either. So anything we can do to rub it out, the better.
Exactly right, yes. So we sort of touched on it a little bit about, you know, preparing. But if someone was thinking about going to see a financial planner, whether or not they're part of the FIRE community or not, do you have a number one tip other than getting prepared to go into that meeting that would help out the process a lot?
I think the big thing is just consider if the planner's listening to you because if they come into it with a preconceived idea or a this is the way we do things for everybody type approach, then that's a bad sign. So yeah, I guess that to me that's the most important is this person listening to me? Do I feel like we can have a bit of back and forth? I don't know that you would get it in the first appointment, but I think you also don't want a planner that just says yes to everything. You want a planner sometimes that says, you know what, Matt, I think that's stupid. I mean, you want that. That's what you're paying for. At the end of the day, as the planner, you're going to do what the client tells you to do. It's their money. But nevertheless, if you don't think it's smart, you've got to be prepared to say, I don't think that's the right thing to do. So as I say, whether you get that in the first appointment, I don't know. But yeah, I think the big thing is just look, are they listening to me here? Are they taking in what I'm after and not just sort of coming up with here's a generic kind of here's what we do for everybody type approach.
It's real funny that you mentioned that, Paul, and I love that answer because I remember when I was like, I think I was back in the property days when I was trying to reach financial independence through property. I hadn't read Mr. Money Moustache yet, the share market. I remember going to, I think it was a financial planner, it may have been an accountancy firm in my hometown. And I remember talking to this guy and he must have been knocking on the door of retirement. He was fairly old. And I remember saying, like, I want to have positively geared property and I want to, you know, 10 properties by the time I'm 30 or something. And he basically just laughed me out of the room and was like, no one does that in property positively geared. You have to negative gear. That's how you save on tax. Like, he really, and I remember just like the whole time, and to your point, I really felt like he wasn't listening to me and my goals. And he was a bit like, don't even think about doing things different, mate. That's dumb. No one does it like that. Everyone that I deal with buys two or three properties that are negatively geared. You negatively gear them for 20 years and you sell them and, you know, all this good stuff. But I totally get where you're coming from with that answer.
And it's interesting, the whole negative gearing with property, isn't it? It's pretty hard to negative gear these days with interest rates as low as they are.
Yeah, so
it sounds like you'd be long gone, but I don't know how people with that viewpoint are ticking over at the moment.
I was going to say, there wouldn't be too much room to move. If you're heavily negatively gearing now when rates are so low,
yeah.
God help you when, you know, they go up.
Your rental yield would have to be pretty miserable, wouldn't it?
Exactly. Is there anything we haven't covered, Paul, that you'd like to touch on just before we wrap things up?
Hey, look, I think it's been a good discussion. I mean, financial autonomy, you know, like we don't, you know, the retire really, people struggle with that. I struggle with that a little bit. But I think generally most people in the FIRE community kind of recognise that they don't mean retirement in terms of a grey nomad. What they mean is choice. And that's, you know, we talk about gaining choice. That's what we focus on. So for the 10% of the FIRE community that are, you know, extreme, frugal, live on Vegemite and toast and spend $5,000 a year, you know, we're not for them. But for the normal people in the FIRE community, which I think is going to be most of your audience, then, I love, you know, the idea, the concept. As I say, we frame it around gaining choice. And myself, I mean, I've done my numbers so I can retire at 60, but ideally I'd like to work till I'm 70. Like, I like what I'm doing. I like working. I've got no desire to retire early, but, you know, we want to do travel. And a few years from now, we'll be living overseas a few months a year and doing all sorts of bits and pieces. So, you know, the idea of the FI element particularly can just be anything, and I find that really exciting, and the fact that people are kind of taking control of their lives, I think, is awesome.
That control of the time is really the main thing about FIRE. Like, I know people get caught up on the retire early, but I've always looked at it like it was retiring from the rat race, retiring from the cubicle, because meaningful work that's you're passionate about that brings you happiness is awesome. You know, I'll be working until I'm dead, but it'll be on something that I enjoy and that I'm passionate about. And it's not because someone tells me to be at a cubicle at 8 o'clock in the morning and tells me to wear this and go home here and have a lunch break here. That bit sucks. But meaningful work is awesome. So I think we're on the same page there.
Totally. That's a nice way to round it out, I reckon. How about you?
Yeah, absolutely, mate. Absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your experiences with us. It was awesome to gain some insights from someone that's been in the industry for over 20 years.
Beauty. Thanks for inviting me on, Matt.
Thanks again to Paul for taking the time and giving us some real life examples on how financial planners are able to assist us with our FIRE journeys. For me personally, I prefer to outsource some of the accounting work and modeling because depending on the situation, it can be quite complex. And from what I found, what I've spent on professional fees is less than the money I've saved. That's been my experience anyway. I also don't have the time or desire to keep on top of tax and trust laws because we invest through a trust. So that's another area that I'm happy to pay and outsource to my accountant. And just to echo what Paul said in the pod, I think having a clear goal and working with someone who's actually listening and speaking your language is the key here. And for those out there listening that have been thinking about speaking to a financial planner, I really hope that this episode has provided you with some good information and maybe made you feel a bit more prepared and confident for that initial consultation. So if that's you and you're feeling more confident, then this episode has achieved what I was hoping it would. If you want to pay it forward, feel free to leave me a review and ratings on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. And with that, that is a wrap, guys. I'll see you on the next episode. Catch ya. Thanks for listening to another episode. For all the show notes and a full transcription of today's episode, head over to aussiefirebug.com. Never miss another episode by subscribing to Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is for educational purposes only. Nothing in this episode should be taken as personal financial advice. You should always do your own research when making any financial decision.